Then she turned back to the mirror. "I guess you don't have to worry you'll be recognized," she said. "No," he said. "Only a few know my face. Him included." That was how she might have talked about the Dark One. It was the way she had referred to him with Albi. As if the man were always in the room with them, never needing to be named. "In Genetrix's doomsday prophecy," she said, "is it one person against another? One chosen, one destructive?" "With Genetrix as the battleground," Mock said, sounding distant. "Two men colliding." She nodded. "And you think Nero is one of them," she said. "Your Dark One. Is that what you called yours?" She thought of him, his waxy face twisting with amusement as he told her to choose. Choose between her and Albi, between one horror and another. She swallowed, hard. "Yes." "Then yes," Mock said. "That's what I think." Sloane finished her braid and tied it off with the band she kept around her wrist. It was so tight that it tugged at her scalp when she moved her head. "Here." Mox went to the little table where she had gulped down a cold can of soup the night before. He picked up his other wrist siphon. It was no finer than the one he wore, but it was more flexible, made of little black plates like the scales of a fish. He made a trilling sound, and all the plates stiffened, like he had sent an electric charge through them. He held it out to her. "I know you can't use it," he said, "but in a city like this, you attract attention without one." Sloane sighed and guided her left hand into the empty glove the plates made. As soon as her fingers were in place, the plates collapsed around her hand, draping over it like a piece of chainmail. Mox turned her hand over to tighten the wrist cuff. For a man with such big hands, there was an elegance to his fingers. "Well," she said, "let's go have a chat with a prophet, I guess." They made their way to the train station on foot at first, walking along the river. Mox had an ease about him that confused her. He kept his hands in his jacket pockets, his head tilted back to take in the daylight. Sloane, however, felt hypervigilant. She twitched at every footstep or distant shout she heard. Away from the loop, the buildings looked even more like ones she recognized. They were made of the red brick that Chicago favored. Rows of two or three flats with strips of grass and leafless trees between them. Every so often they passed something that was otherworldly to her. A house that was just an orb, turning slowly between two needle-like structures. A sculpture that looked like it was collapsing in on itself from one angle and rebuilding itself from another. A store facade that put Art Nouveau vines together with linear stickwork under a mansard roof. A visual mashup that made Sloane cringe. When they reached 31st Street, Mox hailed a taxi with a flash of light from his palm and a squeak from the whistle fastened behind his tooth. Sloane had seen other people wear whistles that way, silver glinting when they smiled and clicking when they ate. It was more convenient than sticking a whistle in your mouth whenever you wanted to do something, she assumed. They were silent in the taxi, both listening to the radio playing from the dashboard. "Stocks of Sifona Technica are at a record high this week after hitting rock bottom last year when reports of misconduct." The driver changed the station to one with instrumental music that sounded like deep-sea recordings of whales. "So you don't really work at the tankard, I take it," she said. "I do, actually," he said brightly. "Weekends and the occasional midweek shift." "How does that work with," Sloane paused, "your other job?" My other job is only demanding at certain times, Mox said. And it doesn't pay very well. The driver poked the radio dial again and the news returned. Reports of a skirmish between the Resurrectionist and the Army of Flickering in Bridgeport last night have surfaced. There was only one casualty, a police officer by the name of Paul Teagan. He is survived by his wife and his 2-year-old son. The driver changed the station again. Mox looked unconcerned, as if the mention of the Resurrectionist had no effect on him whatsoever. They crossed the river and cruised down Canal Street, past a bright pink building that bulged on one side. It turned out to be a grocery store called Hey Presto, with a flying shopping cart as the logo. The taxi stopped in front of Union Station, a wide tan building with a row of Doric columns across the front. She remembered the great hall inside it, with its gridded skylight swelling up toward the heavens in a barrel curve. She had been there only once, as a child, taking the train from central Illinois to the city with Cameron and their mother. She followed Mox in. It was difficult for her to keep up with him, a new experience for someone as tall as Sloane. But Mox's strides were long and purposeful. Once inside, though, he seemed lost in the chaos, twitching when people called out to each other or got too close to him. Sloane thought of the can of green beans slamming into the wall the night before. She dragged him toward the line to purchase tickets. "You've got cash, right?" she said. "Hand it over and stay here. I'll do the talking." When she got back from the ticket counter, he was standing helplessly in the middle of the room, staring at her. She pushed a ticket at him, and together they walked to the right platform, with Sloane directing them. Mox seemed easily confused by signs and distracted by everything around them. She had to drag him along more than once before they made it to a bench where they could wait in the chill of spring when no one else was outside. She wore the cloak he had worn the day before, the hem singed by magical fire. And he wore a jacket not unlike one she might have worn at home. "You don't do a lot of traveling," she said to him once they were seated. Her words found a shape in the air, like smoke. "I do magic," he said, and he chewed his thumbnail. "Never been good at the other stuff."
"Like basic existence?"
To her surprise, he nodded.
"I used to break all my mom's dishes. I'd be holding one, then, I don't know, I'd get distracted and crack. Light bulbs, too. Even forks and spoons, sometimes."
"What you told me about your parents in Arlington," Sloane said.
"Was that true?"
He nodded.
"They put me on a plane to Chicago when I was 9, 10. I've only seen them a couple times since then."
He ripped his thumb out of his mouth.
"They think I'm dead now. It's better that way."
"They don't sound great," she said.
"Maybe they weren't."
His thumb was bleeding at the cuticle. He had bitten down too hard.
"Or maybe they just weren't prepared to have a kid bursting at the seams with magic. It's still,"
he shifted,
"too much. It's too much. Makes me not settled, not stable."
She put a hand on his arm. It was the only thing she could think to do.
"I don't handle magic all that well either," she said.
And she held up the hand that wore the siphon, letting the bright light of day reflect on its scales.
"It's not that I've ever done anything with it, you know. It's just unpredictable. And," she shrugged, "I guess I don't like it." "You don't like it?"
He frowned at her.
"But."
The train was coming, the brakes squealing as it charged into the station. It was bulky and awkward-looking, with protruding lights on the front that blinked until it came to a stop. Mox and Sloane got up and walked along the platform to the last cars so they could avoid the crowd that had gathered around the first few. Sloane climbed the narrow steps into a riot of color. The train's carpet was a garish pattern in yellow, blue, and pink, all triangles and circles and squiggly lines. But it wasn't a standard passenger train. It had compartments, each with two long bench seats facing each other. She ducked into one of them and settled in next to the window. Mox closed the compartment door behind them, whistled, then tugged on the door to test it. It didn't budge. He smiled.
"And you don't like magic," he said to her.
"If the only thing magic did was facilitate my curmudgeonly impulses, I would love it," she said. "Unfortunately, it also has a tendency to rip people to shreds, so..." Mox tipped his head in acknowledgement. He sat down across from her and draped one long arm across the back of the seat. A few people tried the compartment door, but none of them made it through. So when the train pulled away from Union Station, Mox and Sloane were still alone. He was looking out the window, and she found herself looking at him. His face was an assemblage of opposites. Stern nose and strong brow, sitting over a vulnerable mouth. Ears sticking out childlike through the tangle of hair, which had a few threads of gray she hadn't noticed before, despite his obvious youth.
"Feels like you're trying to take me apart," he said without looking away from the window.
"You're hard to figure out," she said. He raised his eyebrows.
"So are you."
"No, I'm not." Sloane shook her head. "You just haven't been to my world.
Something tells me I wouldn't do well there."
"Are you doing well here?" He laughed.
"No, I guess not."
The train charged out of the city, following the path of the river southwest, Lake Michigan behind them. It was the same path Sloane had once taken to go to her childhood home. Her mother had told her to get her things out of the garage because she needed the space. For what, she hadn't said. So Sloane had packed up her stuff, and Cameron's too, and piled all the boxes in a U-Haul to drive back with her. She knew the big empty stretches that awaited them, cornfields crumpled by the chill of autumn, silos standing alone on the horizon. She didn't think Genetrix's rural Midwest would be any different than her own. "Your soldiers will be all right in your absence," she said.
"It's not the first time I've left them," he said. "The working that holds them to life will last a few days without me there to sustain it, so they won't fall apart."
He paused.
"Well, some of them might literally fall apart, but that's easily remedied."
Sloane cringed. "You were very tender with that woman whose arm you stitched back on."
"Oh, Tara?"
He shrugged.
"Well, it's delicate business, sewing someone's arm back on."
"I just didn't realize you had personal relationships with them."
"Ah."
Mox had been calm, sitting back on the bench, his legs crossed at the ankle. But now he sat forward and started tapping his fingers together.
"They're my friends."
She had to be careful. She wasn't sure what might make Mox's magic lash out, and they were on a moving train.
"From before?" she said. "From before they were dead, yes," he said.
"How did you bring them back?" She wasn't sure that she wanted to hear the answer, really, knowing it would make it hard not to try it herself with Albie or Cameron or Bert. Hard not to make them a barrier between her and the world.
"I wanted it," he replied, "more deeply than I have ever wanted anything."
"And that was enough?"
"That's just the part I can't explain."
His hands squeezed into fists. She reached out and covered them with her own. He flinched at her touch and stared at her, dark eyes wide. "We don't have to talk about it," she said, sitting back. But his hands were relaxing, his body uncurling. He was, she thought, a thousand things at once, a language she did not know.
"You said you were at a funeral when you were brought here," he said. "Whose was it?"
It had been a long time since she had thought about Albie. He crept into her mind, of course, when she wasn't vigilant. In unguarded moments before she fell asleep, or when she woke up thinking about what she might tell him, only to realize she would not be telling him anything ever again. But she had not tried to think of him. "Albie," she said. And the name was soft in her mouth. She added, "He was my best friend." Mox nodded as if he knew, and perhaps he did know something about it.
"Was it your Dark One who killed him?"
"No. Well, indirectly, maybe. He killed himself." She hadn't said it out loud before. Not like that, anyway. So plain, so bare. "We took down the Dark One 10 years ago, but Albie never quite got past it." "I guess I haven't either," she forced a laugh. "How do you get over that? The shit we saw. The shit we did." The knot of scars on the back of her hand was a constant reminder of that. "In some ways, it's been easier being here. Doing the same thing over again. I know how to do it. How to be this. But I never quite figured out how to be a regular person." Mox smiled a little.
"I know the feeling,"
he replied. They lapsed into silence then, but there was no tension in it. Both of them just stared out the window, watching the passing buildings grow sparser and sparser. Chapter 34. 10 minutes from the St. Louis station, Sloane felt something within her go quiet. It was as if loud music had been playing and someone had cut the power. Mox gave her a knowing look.
"Haven City," he said. "They're not content to just outlaw magic within the city limits. They also have to dampen it. They would shut it down entirely if it were legal."
"They can do that?" she said.
"A siphon is just a machine that amplifies magical energy. It can also do the opposite."
He offered her a grim smile.
"Which is why it was so alarming to my parents when I had uncontrollable magic despite living in a Haven City."
He really hadn't been exaggerating when he bragged about his raw power, Sloane thought. Her entire body felt heavy. They exited the train and walked down a concrete tunnel that led to the Grand Hall. The building that housed it looked like a castle, with its stone walls and towers and pointed red roofs. But the hall itself looked like Chicago's Union Station, barrel vaulted and spacious. There was no skylight, however, just green tile and decorative knots in the arches, with feminine figures holding lights featured here and there, offering their glow to the heavens. Red booths and chairs were arranged all around them, places for people to sit as they waited. A security officer standing next to the doorway gestured for them to go left, toward an area with metal lockers that was set off by velvet rope. Mox led the way to one of the lockers and unfastened his siphon from his wrist and fingers. Sloane followed his example. He placed the siphon lovingly inside the locker, and she nestled hers beside it. They joined a line of people waiting to exit the roped-off area. At the front were two security officers holding what looked like metal paddles. They ran the paddles up and down people's bodies and around whatever bags they carried, then waved them through, Sloane raised an eyebrow at Mox.
Siphon detectors, he said. Can't have anyone smuggling in magic, can they?
Guess not, Sloane said. The line moved quickly, and Sloane made it past the paddles without a hitch. But the second the woman with the tight bun held her detector up to Mox, he put up both hands and stepped back.
I'm an exception, he said.
The woman sighed. ID card, please. Mox had already taken a white card that looked like a standard driver's license from his back pocket. The security officer held it up to the light for a few seconds, then returned it to him.
All right, she said. You're good.
Mox strolled through the security checkpoint to Sloane's side and led the way to the exit. She waited for him to explain, but it didn't seem like he was going to. So once they were in the taxi line, she poked him hard in the arm.
Exception? She said.
He sighed and bent his head toward hers, almost like he was going to kiss her. She lurched back, but he only pointed to his eye. He held the lower lid down so she could see better. Her cheeks warm, Sloane leaned in. His eyes were dark brown, with a hint of green near the iris. One of them was unremarkable, but in the other, the iris appeared to be broken, as if the pupil were spilling into it. His eyes shifted minutely, and the misshapen pupil glinted, iridescent as a fish scale.
What?
She said.
I don't know, he replied, but it makes those machines go haywire.
He straightened and stepped out of the taxi line for the next available car, leaving Sloane standing there, strangely breathless. Sybil's house was a duplex with a chain-link fence and a set of kitschy wind chimes hanging next to the front door. A blue Toyota sat in her driveway, its bumper rusted. Mox walked up the porch steps, opened the screen door, which had several holes in it, and knocked. When Sloane thought of a prophet, she imagined a man in robes, warning of coming doom, or maybe a fortune teller in some smoky back room shuffling tarot cards. Sybil was neither. She was small, middle-aged, wearing a green cardigan with a little star pinned near the collar. She had flung the door open in a panic or a rage. It was hard to tell. And stuck her finger right in Mox's face.
What have you brought with you?
She demanded. She looked over his shoulder at Sloane, standing at the bottom of her steps.
I'll explain, Mox said. But not out here, obviously.
If you think I'm inviting that into my house, she said, jerking her head toward Sloane, you've got another thing coming.
She stuck her feet into a pair of slippers next to the door and stepped outside.
We'll go into the garage.
Sib, Mox said.
Don't call me that.
She looked around, wild-eyed, like a neighbor was going to pop out of a bush.
Good Lord, boy, have you forgotten where you are?
She charged down the steps, giving Sloane a wide berth, and led them across her neat lawn to the garage. It smelled like mildew and gasoline, and it was packed with old furniture, sagging boxes, and rugs rolled up tight. For all that it looked like an assembly of junk, there was a kind of order to it, Sloane noticed. Sybil wandered through the maze of possessions, turning on lamps, clearing chairs, plucking cobwebs from her hair.
Sit, she said, gesturing to the chairs. You're both huge. It's intimidating to a little old lady like me.
You're not an old lady,
Mox said with unmistakable fondness. But he took one of the seats. Sloane stayed where she was. I'd rather not, she said. It's pretty obvious you don't want me here.
She doesn't mean anything by it, Mox said.
Don't I?
Sybil raised an eyebrow.
The magic coming off the two of you is going to choke me to death, even dampened. So what is she? Is she like you?
Dunno, Mox said. Depends what you think I am, exactly.
Chosen, obviously. You both stink of it.
Sybil replied, and Sloane felt like someone had dropped a stone directly into the center of her.
Chosen?
Sloane looked at Mox.
You're...
Splotches of red appeared on his cheeks and crept down to his throat.
Now, now, Sybil said. Even the dark things of this world are chosen. It's not a badge of honor. If anything, it's like a blinking arrow that says, kill me.
She opened the refrigerator in the corner, took out a bottle of water, and fumbled with the cap, hands trembling.
In this case, though, Mox here is our fated savior, wrapped up in enough siphons to encase a city block in ice, and surrounded by dead bodies. Doesn't bode well for Genetrix.
Mox. Chosen. Sloane felt like a computer that had been fried by a power surge.
Your faith in me always lifts my spirits,
Mox said with a bite to his words.
Sloane was chosen too, Sybil. But in an alternate universe.
Sybil looked Sloane over, then raised an eyebrow.
Interesting, she said. Sit down, girl.
This time, Sloane did, finding a lawn chair near Mox and perching on the edge of it. She was wedged between a lawn statue of a cherub, worn by rain, and a cardboard box with Charlie's room scribbled on it in permanent marker.
On your other world, you fought a battle, Sybil said, sinking down onto a fat tree stump.
She set her water bottle down and sat, slumped, her arms around her knees. She looked so small that way, the bones of her spine sticking out even through her cardigan.
It clings to you still.
Sybil was looking down at Sloane's scarred right hand. Sloane resisted the urge to cover it up.
That was not your battle, Sybil said. Not really.
Sloane's instinct was to argue. It had been her battle. Of course it had. The Dark One had taken her brother from her. That she would fight him had been an inevitability not even worth discussing. But there was too much truth in what Sybil had said for Sloane to deny it. It had been a battle worth fighting. But that didn't mean it was Sloane's. For 10 years, she had been jiggling her knee, waiting for something to make sense, for something new to happen. But until now, it had been too terrible to consider that there might be another fight in front of her, and that it might be hers in a way the other had not.
Why exactly have you come to see me?
Sybil said. I was brought to Genetrix against my will by Aelia and Nero, and whoever else, Sloane said. They told us the Resurrectionist was destroying our world along with Genetrix, and they wouldn't let us go home until we killed him for them. But Mox, she frowned. I just want to know what's real.
What's real?
Sybil sighed and stood.
If we're going to talk about what's real, we'll need whiskey.
The first thing Sybil did was put on a record. Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme by Simon and Garfunkel. The plucking of the guitar was eerie in the dim living room. Its furniture so old that the fabric on the seats was threadbare. The low pink sofa creaked when Mox sat on it. He looked like an adult perched on a child-sized stool. The air had crackled around him when he walked into the room, and Sybil had told him, sharply, to keep himself under control. It had no effect. Mox just scowled. Sybil went into the kitchen to pour whiskey, and as they waited for her to return, Sloane browsed her bookshelves. There were no books on them, just a vast collection of National Geographics and knitting magazines. There were porcelain figurines, too, of ballet dancers and stretching cats and hot air balloons. It was as if Sybil had seen an encyclopedia entry about what belonged in a grandmother's house and had replicated it exactly.
down to the doilies on the mahogany coffee table. When the second song on the album started to play, Sloane snorted.
"You really like to wrap yourself in cliches, don't you?"
she said to Sybil when the woman returned with three tumblers of whiskey. Sybil smiled.
"The song discusses patterns repeating themselves," Sybil said. "I thought you would both appreciate the sentiment."
Sloane sipped the whiskey, which was like swallowing a mouthful of smoke. Her eyes watered as she tried to stifle a cough. Sybil, on the other hand, downed half her glass at once, then sat in the recliner next to the record player to watch the record spin.
"This is a gift I didn't choose and didn't want," Sybil said after a while. "I was 2 years old when the Tenebris incident occurred, and 14 when I began to go into trances. They were frightening. I myself didn't remember them. But I was told I spoke in riddles, as if possessed. And people avoided me once my ramblings began to come true. No one wants to know their future, not really."
She sipped the whiskey, and Sloane perched on the arm of the couch where the pink fabric was torn and some of the stuffing was hanging out.
"It was an uncommon gift, even among the magically adept. And even more uncommon was the large scale of my predictions. They pertained to world events, the outcomes of battles, natural disasters, the passage of laws, and eventually, the end of everything. I have a recording of it, actually."
She stood and set the tumbler down on the table next to the record player. She lifted the needle from the record, then opened a nearby cabinet and searched through a large basket of cassette tapes. Sloane wasn't close enough to read the labels, but they were homemade, curling at the edges. Sybil found the right tape and took it to a little cassette player in a corner of the room on a shelf next to the National Geographic's. There was a high whine as the tape rewound. Sloane drank more of her whiskey and tried not to look at Mox. Sybil pressed play and stood before the cassette player like she was standing at an altar. The recording crackled and popped at first, then steadied, a voice taking shape.
"It will be,"
the voice said, low and strange.
"The end of Genetrix, the unmaking of worlds. Something stands between Genetrix and its twin. The Dark One will excise it, and the worlds will be crushed together, and that will be the end of all."
Sloane's body jerked to attention. She thought of the thread of light she had seen connecting Genetrix to Earth at the bottom of the Chicago River. This world and its twin, the needle. The low croak went on.
"The Dark One of Genetrix will be hidden, but not secret, with a thirst that will never be slaked."
Sybil, standing before her cassette player, was mouthing the words along with the recording.
"Their equal is the hope of Genetrix, born marred by magic and mastered by a power previously unknown to us."
Sloane watched Sybil's finger tapping her leg, as if the prophecy were a song and she was dancing to it. Perhaps it was. Perhaps the light threads she had seen made music, like the strings of a violin or a guitar. And the music came to Sybil in prophecies.
"Twice will equals greet each other anew, and the fate of the worlds is in their hands."
Mox was staring at his hands, clasped between his knees so tightly his knuckles had gone white. The Sybil of the recording spoke the last line again, but so quietly that Sloane could hardly hear it. And then the tape stopped. "Your eye," Sloane said. "You're marred by magic." Sybil was still standing behind her, but she found herself speaking only to Mox. Mox nodded. He seemed unsteady, like he might shake apart at any moment.
"Nero was my teacher for a decade,"
Mox said, lower lip trembling slightly.
He betrayed me.
His eyes were locked on Sloane's. The fault in his iris now imperceptible again without the light shining through it.
He murdered the army meant for the Chosen One. The first army of Flickering. He blamed it on me. Twisted the prophecy against me.
The words scraped out of his throat, sending a chill down Sloane's spine. She thought of the resurrectionist's long fingers working stiff thread through the soldier's detached arm and drawing it tight. Of the desperate way he had screamed Ziva's name in the street near the safe house. If his raised soldiers were the army meant for the Chosen One, then of course he had known them before they died. Had trusted them to stand with him against an evil he didn't comprehend. Nero. The man with the unquenchable thirst. They would meet on the battleground of Genetrix, and the fate of the world, the worlds, was in their hands.
Excerpt from The Magic of Cruelty by Erica Perez. In his book, The Manifestation of Impossible Wants, A New Theory of Magic, Arthur Solowell makes the bold claim that desire cannot be threatened or manipulated into being. While I agree that simple threats do not produce reliable magical results, it is naive to suggest that coercion is never effective in influencing magic. Perhaps Mr. Solowell was fortunate enough to grow up in a community of moral adults who never exerted their influence against children, but I was not. I saw the way that cruel parents shaped my peers and therefore their desires. And it came in all forms, too. Sometimes a strict religious upbringing turned an open mind into a closed one that could perform only basic practical workings. Sometimes utter neglect created a complete disregard for boundaries, pushing someone to involve other people in unethical workings. Pressure to succeed at the highest level turned friends away from creativity and imagination in their magic. Emotional abuse twisted a person's work to become more brutal, less finessed. One of my most talented friends lost the ability to do workings entirely and now lives in St. Louis, a haven city. A desire is not a whim, as Solowell aptly states, but a desire is not immovable, unchangeable. The variable to consider is power. Who has power over the individual in question? Does anyone have too much power? Are any of those in power abusive spouses, family members, or friends? Is the individual particularly susceptible to manipulation with a desire to please, or simply to avoid pain? Have they been isolated from their peers or the outside world? We must learn to recognize the signs. We cannot pretend this problem doesn't exist. The future of our children depends on it.
Chapter 35. There wasn't much to say after that, so Sybil invited Sloane and Mox to stay for dinner, likely to fill the silence. Sloane accepted because she didn't know what else to do. So they were all trapped together in the little house, orbiting each other in silence. Sybil busied herself at the stove, shoving lemon slices in the body cavity of a raw chicken. And Sloane knelt on the beige carpet near the cassette player, looking through the magazines. There were photographs of countries she had never heard of, their names and shapes and fates altered by the division between the universes. She saw rough-looking siphons on the hands of villagers in rural Romania and remote Siberia. An oddity still, the accompanying article said, but not unheard of in the younger generation. Mox said he doesn't think the drains are controlled by anyone, she said, looking up from a photograph of a tractor on a small farm in Argentina. There was an island separating the kitchen from the living room. Sybil stood behind it, chopping something. Onions, judging by the smell. Mox had disappeared a few minutes before, enticed by Sybil's offer of a shower and a change of clothes. Her husband had left plenty when he died, and they were still in her bedroom dresser. Sloane could hear the spray of water down the hall. "It's important not to confuse causation with correlation," Sybil said, scrutinizing the pepper grinder she held in both hands. Even though she was a widow, she was still wearing her wedding band. "However, we know that a drain happens every time one of you shows up to kill him, so they do seem to be related." "Wait, they do?" Sloane set the magazine down and got to her feet. "So you think they're maybe caused by the presence of an outsider?" "All I know is you're not supposed to be here," Sybil said. "Maybe the drains are like the world's allergic reaction to you." At Sloane's raised eyebrow, she scowled. "Well, I don't know, girl. I'm not a scientist." Sloane leaned against the island. "What did you do for a career? Spitting out prophecies probably not that lucrative, right?" "It's not lucrative at all in a haven city," Sybil said. "But magic grinds up against me like sandpaper, so I didn't have much of a choice, did I?" She shrugged. "I was a teacher. Retired now, obviously." "Grinds up against you like sandpaper," Sloane repeated. "That's odd." "What does it feel like for you?" Sybil asked. "Like sticking my head in a vise," Sloane said. "Makes my hands go numb sometimes. I'm not wild about it myself, actually."
"Hmm."
Sybil put on her oven mitts and picked up a heavy pot with the chicken in it. Sloane moved forward to open the oven door for her, and the chicken went in. "He loves it," Sybil said, nodding toward the hall bathroom where Mox was showering. "To him, it looks like beams of light or something. He plays magic like guitar strings. Pluck, your gravity's gone. Pluck, your house is on fire. Delightful." Beams of light. It sounded like the working Aelia had done on Sloane before she had dived in the river. Maybe Aelia had learned it from Nero, who had learned it from Mox. "Have you ever met Nero?" Sloane said.
"I have."
Sybil's eyes hardened. "He wears masks on top of masks, that man. Can't ever get a look at what's underneath." She set the kitchen timer, which was shaped like an egg. Painted on it was the phrase, "Have an excellent breakfast." "You, girl," she said, leaning closer to Sloane, "have the grittiest of all magic. Fate's grabbed you hard and it's not letting go. So I want you to remember something." She closed her fingers around Sloane's arm tightly, her grip strong for a woman of her size. "The line between a chosen one and his opposite is hair fine, so don't get too cozy on one side of it." The smell of onions was pungent enough to make Sloane's eyes sting. She tugged her arm free. "All I want is to go home," she said. "That," Sybil said, her eyes glittering, "is the fattest lie I've ever heard. You want everything. You're a bottomless pit. Makes me feel exhausted just thinking about you." "You know, you're not such a peach yourself," Sloane snapped. Mox called out from the bedroom, his low voice carrying easily across the house. "Sloane, can I get a hand?" She remembered the blade stuck above his hip just the night before and left the kitchen. The hallway was painted the same milky pink as the living room sofa, and it was covered with pictures of Sybil and her husband and children, Sloane assumed, from the way people were arranged, stiff and formal. It was hard to believe that this woman, with her aggressively normal house and family, could have spoken so many prophecies, including one about the end of the world. No wonder magic was so repellent to her, It was the opposite of the life she had built for herself, in all its rigidity. Mox was standing in the bedroom wearing a pair of worn blue jeans and a gray t-shirt, which surprised her, since she hadn't seen either type of garment since she arrived on Genetrix. He stood braced against Sybil's dresser, hands tight around the edge and his head down. His hair was straight when it was wet, and longer, almost brushing his shoulders. His feet were bare. He was, she thought, very solid. Spare through his midsection, likely due to the difficulty of his life for the past 10 years, living on cans of soup. But his long arms were sturdy enough to fill out t-shirt sleeves, and his shoulders were broad, like he was built for more muscle than he had. Maybe in another universe. And he was also losing control. The pressure of the air around him was so different from that of the air in the hallway that Sloane's ears popped when she drew closer to him. "Sorry," he said in a tight, small voice without looking at her. "But you calmed me down on the train." "Oh." Sloane tried to think of what she had done on the train. She'd touched his hands. The prospect of touching him right now was far more daunting. On the train, it had been instinct. But here, she would have to mean it. Air pressed against her face the same way it had when she was a kid and biked to the top of Oak Street just so she could ride down again, like she could take fistfuls of it. "Coward," she said to herself, and she put a hand on Mox's shoulder right where it joined with his neck. His wet hair tickled her knuckles. She leaned closer to him. "What is it?" she asked. He didn't answer. He was hyperventilating, she noted, judging by the shifting of his rib cage under his shirt. She put her hand on the back of his neck and squeezed lightly. His skin was hot to the touch. It had been a long time since she had touched someone who wasn't Matt in this way. Vulnerable and presumptuous. "Talking about him. All the memories," Mox said, and it sounded like his teeth were gritted, though he was still hidden behind a curtain of hair. "It's a lot," Sloane supplied. "Well, let's just sit for a second." She pressed down gently, and as Mox went to his knees, she went with him. She sat with her back against the dresser, one of the drawer pulls digging into her spine. He knelt there, his arms shaking, still refusing to look at her. "Me and my friend, the one who died," she said, and she felt that old, familiar terror rising up inside her. "We were taken captive by Earth's Dark One. It was only for a day." She dug her shoes into the carpet. Sybil had raised an eyebrow when she walked into the house without removing them, but she hadn't said anything. "But the Dark One gave me a choice." She felt a sensation like knives piercing her throat when she swallowed. "He told me that one of us, me or Albie, would suffer. And I would decide which one, you or him." She didn't close her eyes. If she had, she wouldn't have seen it. The Dark One's placid face as he waited for her answer in the doorway, leaning against the frame. "I didn't want to, but he said that if I didn't, it would happen to us both. And why should both of us endure that?" Mox had straightened ever so slightly to look at her through his curtain of hair. It was curling as it dried. "So, in the end," Sloane said, forcing out the words that she had never, not even once, said out loud. "I chose him. I spared myself." The horror was so close to the surface now. If she had wanted to, she could have released it. Shuddered with it. Screamed it into being. She was afraid to look at Mox. Afraid to see the revulsion she was sure he felt. He had killed, but only to save himself. He had not done this. Thrown a dear friend into the fire to keep himself from burning. No one Sloane knew had done that. But she made herself look at him anyway, because she deserved it. Deserved to know just how disgusting she was. How she had betrayed Albie and ruined him and set him on a path that would lead to his death. But Mox was just looking at her. The pressure in the air had diminished. Sloane no longer felt like she was chewing on every breath. "I know," she said, choking a little. "About the rage that takes over when you think about someone. About the rage that changes you." Mox tucked his hair behind his ears with both hands. His face looked thinner this way, and pale. He was tired, and no wonder. He had lived for years just scraping by in abandoned buildings and warehouses, with an army that fell to pieces every time it moved. And sometimes even when it didn't, and the burden of what had happened to them falling on his shoulders. He was as tired as she was. He said, "There's a thought experiment, moral philosophy, called the trolley problem. Have you heard of it?" She shook her head no. "Basically, it says there's a trolley on a track, and if it goes one way, it will kill 5 people. But if you flip the switch, it will only kill 1. And you're supposed to say whether you would flip the switch. Whether you could bear to be directly responsible for a death, even if you're sparing lives." He scowled. "I always hated it. Hated it. And I used to tell my teacher that what I would do is take the person forcing me to make the choice and throw him on the tracks, because he's the one who really deserved it." He smiled a little, forcing a crease into his cheek. "Not really the point of the exercise," he said. He covered her hand, balanced on her kneecap with his own. It made her feel small, but in a good way. In a way she never got to feel, being as tall as she was. "But the person who asks you to make that kind of choice, between you and a friend, between pain and guilt, fuck that person." His hand tightened on hers. For a moment, they just stared at each other, and she felt like the horror was farther away, that it had settled deeper inside her again. They ate Sybil's chicken in silence. All of them transparently relieved when Sloane took her last bite. Mox and Sloane busied themselves in the kitchen, scooping potatoes into containers for the refrigerator, scrubbing plates and pots. Sybil let them take over and went out to the back steps to smoke a cigarette. "My afternoon indulgence," she had called it. Not that Mox or Sloane had said anything. Then she started up the engine of the old Toyota and drove them to the train station, wearing thick glasses with green tortoiseshell frames. As they drove past the rows of low brick buildings and empty lots that patched the land between Sybil's house and the station, Sloane marveled at how barren everything looked without the magic-influenced architecture that defined Chicago. She had gotten used to it, even in the short time she had been on Genetrix. The most interesting buildings in St. Louis were churches, which seemed to have gotten more plain in the absence of unrealist or bygoneist architects. Flat, white buildings with sharp corners that reminded her of minimalist structures on Earth, but with glass block windows arranged in the shape of crosses. Sybil gave Mox a hard look when they pulled up to the curb next to the station and said, "Keep your eyes open. He leaned in and kissed her cheek, even though she looked just as stern and irritable as she had since they arrived.
Thanks.
Sloane got out without saying goodbye. She was distracted by a buzzing sensation on the surface of her skin, like a purring cat. They had to be closer to the limits of the magic-canceling siphon's power here. When Mox shut his door and the Toyota pulled away, she turned to him and asked, "How did you meet her anyway?" "I never got to meet the prophet on Earth. I did a lot of poking around at the camel," he said, tipping his head back to look at the sky. It was cloudy, the sun covered with a pale haze.
"They could never keep me out of any room for long. Something's off. Do you feel that?"
He wiggled his fingers.
"All bright and shiny for me. Magic's back."
"Why would they turn off the dampening?"
"I can think of only one reason," he said. "Because they know I can use magic whether the dampener is functional or not. And they want to be able to use it too."
"Well," Sloane said, "let's get our siphons before they find us then." Mox led the way to the row of lockers where they had stored the siphons. When he entered their combination and opened the door, it was with a sigh of relief. The siphons were there, side by side. He put the green one on his hand and flexed his fingers, then took the tooth attachment from its little pouch and stuck it in place over a canine. Sloane put on her siphon grudgingly, hating the coldness of it against her hand, and the weight, and the way it pinched her wrist. Mox watched her fumbling with the clasp for a few seconds, then reached across her to take her wrist in his hands. He tucked a finger under the band to test its tightness, then pushed the clasp in place with a flick of his wrist. She felt heat where his fingertip had been against her skin, and she knew what that heat meant and where it might lead if she let it. But it felt like another betrayal. She shut the locker door and turned back to the grand hall. In Chicago, most of the people she saw wore the dramatic clothing that, she had learned, was a trademark of the magical elite. But in St. Louis, a haven city, there were no sweeping fabrics designed to display throat siphons or wrist siphons, no elaborate updos dotted with round gold clips that accentuated ear siphons, no modern mimicries of wizard garb. In fact, the fashion seemed to have gone in another direction as a reaction. A woman in a collar so high it cradled her jaw rushed past them, tiny buttons drawing a line from throat to belly button. A man in a startlingly bright pink and orange shirt had fabric around his wrists and upper arms, but between them was mesh showing bare skin, untouched by magical technology. A sullen-looking child wore a gray shift that looked like a monk's robe. The child eyed Sloane's wrist, then scowled at her. Sloane scowled back. Then a quick movement caught her eye. Someone darting behind a pillar. She reached behind her and slapped Mox's stomach a little too hard. "Ouch," he said.
"What?"
Sloane raised her siphon hand and pointed it at a flickering soldier approaching under the shadowed awning that framed the room. Mox stiffened and turned too, facing the other direction so they were almost back to back.
"Sloane?"
She recognized the voice. It belonged to Etta, who had been with her and the others during the drain. Etta stepped around the red faux velvet furniture on Sloane's left, her hand up and gleaming black. A spark danced across her palm, her siphon ready to launch its working. "Hey there," Sloane said, her gaze shifting from Etta to the other soldier, a small, spry woman with a crown of curly black hair. She wore a siphon over her eye, a half mask of smooth chrome fitted to her eye socket and cheekbone.
You're kind of harshing the vibe of my St. Louis vacation, Etta. Sloane, he's used some kind of working on you, Etta said steadily. Some kind of mind manipulation. All the civilians around her had already ducked behind tables and chairs, huddled together in the corners, or fled out the doors. The little girl in the monk garb was crouched near Etta's feet, shivering. Nope, Sloane said. Next theory. I don't have any other theories, Etta said. Here's one. You've been lied to, Sloane said. She was just delaying, scanning the room for emergency exits. There was a solid wall of lockers on her right.